Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail. I directed that our surveillance be stepped up.
If you seek peace, Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Geeked on History podcast. My name is Nick, and today's episode is the first in a series of episodes where we'll be talking about the same topic. This is a totally geeked on history. Now, at the time of recording, it's September of 2014. And this time of year, the fall time, may not really mean much to our foreign listeners, and may not even mean much to our domestic listeners. But what it does mean for a number of people in the United States is that fairly soon there may be a changing of the guards, so to speak. Yes, that's right. It's campaign season. 2014 is an off-presidential election year, but the congressional election years are really no less important to the American political system. Along with the long parade of campaign promises made, later broken, hands shaken, babies kissed, favor money taken, if you're cynical. Along with all that will be the same common complaints about the state of politics in the United States. And among these complaints is a term that's made its way into our lexicon, a term that people love to use, and it's also a term that people think that they've invented recently. That term is mudslinging. Mudslinging is a term that we use to describe when political candidates use irrelevant and maybe embarrassing information against their opponent in order to win a term in office. But mudslinging, more than anything, though, really represents what most people see as the biggest problem with modern politics. Almost like it's something unique about politics in the last 20 to 30 years that just doesn't exist anywhere else. That's what most people seem to think about mudslinging. The truth, though, is that these hostile campaigns that we see today are really nothing new in any way, shape, or form. And after you listen to this series of podcasts, you'll think that today's elections are a trip to the petting zoo in comparison. Because in this series, we're going to be talking about Tammany Hall. Now, the truth about hostile campaigns is that they're nothing new. On the show already, we've talked a little bit about the election of 1828. If you'd like to know more about that election, I really encourage you to listen to the Geeked on History series on Andrew Jackson. As I said in the previous podcast, 1828 was the benchmark for really nasty elections. Really nasty presidential elections, at least. But it wasn't just the nastiness of past elections that have been around since time immemorial either. Another mainstay of election year politics is the ever-present complaint about corruption. And the fact is that rampant corruption has been built into every political system that the world has ever seen. Yes, there are corrupt officials. That hasn't changed for decades, for centuries, and it's not likely to change anytime soon either. In the United States, though, we had an institutionalized form of corruption. Corruption so ingrained in the government's daily business that the institution itself would become synonymous with everything wrong with American politics. For this podcast, I struck gold on a source and found a book called The History of Tammany Hall. It was published in 1917 by a guy named Gustavus Myers. I'll be referencing this book heavily throughout the podcast since it's about as close to a primary source as you can get. In fact, it's so close to being a primary source that Mr. Myers claims to have had trouble finding a publishing house willing to take the risk of publishing such a history. By the end of this podcast, you'll know exactly why. You see, because when it was written in 1917, Tammany still had power. Power that by this time, in 1917, it had spent 100 years building. It may surprise you to know that Tammany Hall is nearly as old as the United States. It was found on May 12, 1786, with the full name of the Sons of St. Tammany or the Columbian Order. It's a little bit like a tribe called Quest like that. You have to say the whole thing. Luckily for us, though, the organization went by a couple other shorter names, including the Society of St. Tammany or just plainly Tammany Hall. Although, if you're being a language purist, Tammany Hall would refer specifically to the building that the organization used in the same way that we might use the White House to refer to decisions made by the presidential administration. The Society of St. Tammany that we're referring to is just one of many societies that claimed the namesake of an old chief of the Lenni Lenape tribe, a man who went by the name Tamanend. Tamenend was a celebrated peacemaker in the history between Native Americans and English settlers, in and around the area that would later become Philadelphia. Legend says that Tamenend was one of the signers of William Penn's first treaty with the natives on April 23, 1683, and that his wigwam stood on the grounds that would later become Princeton University. According to the Smithsonian, the original Tammany Society, or Tammanies as we may call them from now on, was organized in Philadelphia on May 1, 1772, with the name Sons of King Tammany. Now, the purpose of these early Tammany groups was aligned with the pro-independence movement in the United States. It was more of a social group, a group where people could get together, usually men, could get together and discuss popular political topics like independence. Another group that would have been sort of an affiliate group with the early Tammany societies would have been a group like the Sons of Liberty. So in these early days before telecommunications, groups like the Sons of Liberty had to meet in person in order to organize their activities. So if you were going to have a rally of some kind, you had to meet in person. You could send letters, but it just wasn't as efficient in communicating with massive groups of people. So these groups became publicly known more as social clubs than as revolutionary encouragers, because that still, before the revolution, was illegal at the time. So like groups such as the Sons of King Tammany or the Sons of Liberty began to gain in popularity, and as this anti-heretical rule sentiment began to build up in the colonies, there was also a loyalist movement that popped up that involved groups taking pro-monarchy names that mirrored groups like the Sons of Liberty. They took names like the Sons of St. George to show their support for the king. The Society of St. Tammany was just one of these groups that held an opposing charter and took a name as a counterbalance to these pro-monarchy societies. So the Society of St. George versus the Society of St. Tammany, you could kind of understand the tongue-in-cheek name that was meant to be delivered by these titles. Now, when these Tammany groups took their name, they didn't just take the name. It wasn't just a passing reference symbolically to somebody who was admired for their wisdom and happened to be native. The entire persona of Tamenend was adopted along with the name. The whole culture was hijacked. It's definitely a reflection of the sensitivities, or, you know, possibly lack thereof, that groups like the Tammanies took on Native American dress and used terms we commonly associate with Native Americans, like the word sachem and wigwam. The whole thing is really super racist when we look back on it, but in those days, of course, whether it bothered anyone was really of little consequence to the groups who took that culture and made it their own. If we are going to take this broad perspective on who exactly took the Native American culture and made it their own, though, it wasn't just the Tammany societies. There were lots of other American groups that were just as into the images that Native Americans offered, and were more than happy to rip that off for their own gain. One example we're surely all familiar with is when the Sons of Liberty boarded the HMS Dartmouth, dressed as natives, and threw all the tea cargo overboard. Now, it wasn't really clear to me in my research where people got the idea to take on this Native American image during their independence activities. So when we're talking about these early independence societies, we should really get our ducks in a row. There's a few different ones that we've referred to already that are very separate groups. We have the Sons of Liberty, the Sons of St. Tammany, and then there's a third one coming up that came much later than the other two, called the Society of the Red Men, or the Improved Order of the Red Men. The Improved Order of the Red Men was just another group that operated much like the other two did, in that they were pro-independence groups, who also happened to take a sort of native image whenever they would go out and participate in rallies or any independence-related demonstrations. And the reason that I even bring up this group is just to say that the Tammany Society that we've been talking about so far became the Improved Order of the Red Men at some point. It was a fraternal society that became something else later on. So when we get deeper into the content for this podcast, you'll realize that we're talking really about two major different groups here. We're talking about a fraternal society, which was called the Sons of St. Tammany or the Columbian Order. And then later on, we have another group that was purely political, which we'll refer to as Tammany Hall. So two distinct groups with a shared history. And as we said before, this early Society of St. Tammany was a group that was political in nature, but it was more of a fraternal organization. It existed before the Revolution. Now, once the Revolution was over, and there were no more independence-related activities that needed to be done for the sake of independence, the agenda sort of switched. Instead of having to spend all their time trying to find a way in order to win the struggle for independence, the Society of St. Tammany had plenty of time to spend on political action. And it's right around this time, in the late 1700s, that we really start to dig into the group that we're going to talk about in depth in this series, when the Sons of St. Tammany goes from being a fraternal organization to being a purely political organization. So now that we understand a little bit about what the group was and where it came from, it's really worth it to spend a little bit of time understanding how the leadership system works, because that's really where the crux of most of the stuff we're going to talk about happened, was at the top of the organization. So let's get into that. At the top of the group, you had the Grand Sachems. Record says that there was really technically an honorary class higher than the Grand Sachem called the Kichi Okime, or Great Grand Sachem, that was given to the President of the United States. Holders of the title of Great Grand Sachem were George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, and of course, Andrew Jackson. The title would later become obsolete, though, and wouldn't be used after Andrew Jackson. And although this title was technically higher than Grand Sachem, there really wasn't any power involved. It was really just an honorary title. In fact, most of the time, the people that actually got this title didn't spend any time in the Tammany organization. It was really just a way of promoting a certain person. So after the Grand Sachems were the Sachems, then the Sagamores, then the Master of Ceremonies, then Scribes, then Secretaries, and finally the Wiskinski, or the Doorkeeper. They actually had a formal title for their doorkeepers. Now, the Grand Sachems were the prime leadership of the entire group. There was only ever one Grand Sachem who was elected annually from a pool of 13 Sachems in the organization, and these guys were the top dogs of the group. But it was still based on a democratic system. There were still votes lodged to determine the direction of any given political action campaign. It was built into the group that no one person was going to make the choices for everybody. And even though there was a hierarchy involved, the votes were there to keep everything fair. And now that we've got the leadership out of the way, I feel much better. I feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders, because this is a lot of content we're going to go over, and understanding what the leadership looks like is crucial to understanding the rest of what we're going to talk about. So this is also a really good time to get to know the scene that we're looking at here. Tammany Hall's main political body sat around various places in New York City, and as we go through this podcast, I'll explain where the headquarters was located in the city at the time of the content that I'm giving you. But before there was a central headquarters building, what would come to be known as the overarching Tammany Hall organization would circulate between different taverns and back rooms for their official business, usually at a place called Barden's Tavern on Broadway in New York. It's also really important later on to understand that New York, the way that it was back then, is not New York the way that it is today. New York back then in the late 1700s and early 1800s was a crowded, dirty mess of a place in most parts of the city. I bet some of you right now are saying, well, not much has changed, but a lot really has changed if you think about how it was back then. For one thing, we're talking about dirt roads. And while that may not sound like a lot, imagine dirt roads in a city. Dirt roads where everybody gets dirtier all the time. And that's just the basic level of hygiene that everybody has to deal with. It's almost a sort of equalizing factor, if you want to think of it that way. But this constant shifting of meeting places would be how Tammany Hall would do business up until 1798, when Tammany Hall finally got its first official headquarters. The so-called Long Room in Martling's Tavern at Nassau and Spruce. This is when the term wigwam came into popular Tammany-related speech. And incidentally, this would be the location of the future City Hall of New York. It's also around this time that Tammany Hall became the common name for the group. Alright, so now that we've got a little bit of the basics out of the way, the leadership, which is very important, and the location, which is also very important, let's take a quick step back in the timeline to really understand how this sweet, sweet corruption got started. After the Revolutionary War, the newly founded United States had a bit of a crisis to attend to. We'd won all this independence, but now we were realizing that we had really just been dogs chasing cars. What do we do once we get independence? It was a question that nobody really knew the answer to. Nobody knew how to set up a government. The only leadership that we really had was, for the most part, people that knew how to fight a war. And even those people didn't know their craft quite as well as they needed to in order to win a really fair fight. What I'm referring to here specifically is our first president, George Washington, and the fact that as a general, he was just awful. He was terrible. But yeah, this question was lingering. What do we do now that we've won our independence from Great Britain? There had been a lot of ideological talk before the war started, but once it got down to business, when the common threads which brought Americans together before the war were gone, the prospect of building a functioning government was a lot easier said than done. So now once we got rid of this British tyranny, this thing that really brought us all together as Americans, what do we do now? What do we find in common besides a common enemy? And it was at that time that the threads of differing politics lie bare and raw against differing factions in the United States. So if we really want to talk about where Tammany Hall fits in this political landscape of things after the Revolutionary War, we have to understand one of the most central divisions in early American politics, the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists, also known as the Democratic Republicans. Now, to the common ear, the name Democratic Republican is going to be really, really counterintuitive. It's not going to make a lot of sense. But what you really need to understand as a listener in this is that the Democratic Republicans is really just another name for the Anti-Federalists. So if we just put aside what we know about politics today, Democrats and Republicans and how they operate in today's landscape, even before they operated during Lincoln's time, per se, let's just put all that aside and just start fresh. The Democratic Republicans that we're going to be talking about today are their own thing. They exist in a vacuum apart from all these other things. So when we talk about them, just keep that in mind. I'll be guiding you through the ideologies as we go, so just feel comfortable when I explain it. So Tammany Hall was a strictly Democratic Republican organization, or Anti-Federalist organization. But the differences between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists were essentially the same as any other political rift. So in this instance, you had the Federalists, which are generally representing the interests of the rich. They believed that the wealthiest and most educated members of American society were entitled exclusively to government leadership. And truth be told, they were just as willing to utilize corrupt tactics in order to press their own goals as anybody else was. But they also had a much more thought-out political agenda than just to defend the interests of the rich. They also believed in strong manufacturing and trade. They wanted a strong federal government, and they were more into the idea of a loose interpretation of the Constitution. I'm sure some of this is already sounding familiar to you, because these are discussions that we still have as Americans. This whole thing still hasn't been settled after over 200 years. But these goals were in stark contrast, the polar opposite to what the Democratic Republicans were after. They were much more into the idea of a distributed political model, that common folks more than anybody else should be the biggest stakeholders in government leadership. It was a populist message, and they wanted to see more powers go to the states rather than to have a very strong central government. They also felt that farming should be the focus of the U.S. rather than trade and industrialization. And of course, being anti-federalists, they also had very strong beliefs that the Constitution should be interpreted as literally as possible. So again, you really can see how not a lot has changed since these days have gone by in politics in the United States. We still have people that have a very vested interest in constitutional liberties versus a much more loose interpretation of what the Constitution says. We still have people that are interested in farmers' rights versus industrialization. And we definitely have a very popular uprising these days about states' rights versus a central government. All of these are just topics that don't seem to die, and even though they sound familiar to us, this was the state of politics back then, and I really think that the lack of change there is going to help us all understand how things were back then. We can relate to these people a little bit better, knowing that their issues are our issues. And just like our politics today, we tend to project these issues onto certain people. We tend to use our political candidates as screens, so to speak, for which we project our political beliefs onto. Are you an Obama supporter or are you a Ron Paul supporter? Just saying that you align yourself with one candidate versus the other says a lot about what you believe politically. And again, things weren't much different back then. In these early days of this existential struggle for the future of the United States, both groups were led by two early American titans whose name you probably are already familiar with, but probably more for infamous reasons. Representing the Federalists was a man named Alexander Hamilton. Historians remember Hamilton as the man who essentially built the American economic system. He was so influential in the basic building blocks of the American system that if you take an American $10 bill out of your wallet right now, you'll see his face on the front. So it's interesting that one of the few men who wasn't president and managed to secure himself a place on our hallowed currency was a man in charge of one of these early political parties and just happened to be the guy in charge of building the American economic system early on. So that should say a lot about his infamy. And on the other side of the debate was another political heavyweight by the name of Aaron Burr. Burr had fought in the Continental Army during the American Revolution and was chosen as Thomas Jefferson's first vice president. Did I say that Thomas Jefferson was an anti-federalist? Oh yeah, TJ was definitely anti-federalist. But both these men came to power in their respective organizations. Aaron Burr, of course, being the unofficial leader of Tammany Hall, and Alexander Hamilton at the helm of another group called the Society of the Cincinnati. Now, the Society of the Cincinnati was the kryptonite to Tammany Hall. These were two groups with very opposing political ideas, with two very opposing political leaders. I should also say that if you caught it before, I'll just repeat this. Aaron Burr was not the official leader of Tammany Hall. He was not a sachem. He was one of the only leaders, in fact, the only leader of Tammany Hall to ever be as influential on the organization as he was and not hold an official leadership title. But I'll just go ahead and break it down for you guys. Hamilton and Burr, not the greatest of friends. It may come as a shock to you that these two men didn't get along very well, but that's what happens when people have this deep political rift separating each other. They tend to not be the greatest friends, unless they could put their differences aside, and Hamilton and Burr could not put their differences aside. But as I said before, Aaron Burr had a lot of pull in the organization. He had so much pull, in fact, that he had a whole group, a subset of anti-federalists called the Burrites that followed his every whim. They were disciples, if you will, and they would fight for Burr's honor and his ideas till the bitter end. If you need more evidence, then trust me on this one, guys. It's nearly impossible to do something as simple as organize a group of old friends for a night out at the pub. When you and your peers are so close that they start stealing your name and using it to describe your clique as if they were wearing some kind of creepy Buffalo Bill-style skin suit, you know you're either in a hardcore early American political movement, or you might just be in a cult. The differences still aren't really clear to me. But it wasn't very long after until Burr started using his political accesses to make this incredible political machine work for his own interest. In fact, many historians would agree that without Tammany Hall support in the 1800 election, Jefferson may not have won the presidency. You see, the election of 1800 was a major upset. Thomas Jefferson won over incumbent candidate John Adams in a victory that would be called the Revolution of 1800. The 1800 election was the opening salvo for what would become a dynasty for Tammany Hall. But you may be wondering, how was that even possible? How could one organization hold so much power that they could swing federal elections in favor of one presidential candidate versus the other? Well, remember that Tammany Hall was an anti-federalist body, and that the anti-federalists were a populist movement. If the popular vote is truly the deciding factor in any given democratic society, then the populists would obviously have a distinct advantage right off the bat, right? In other words, an appeal to the masses should get you more votes than an appeal to the elite classes whose numbers should be fewer. The real key to any well-run campaign, though, is organization. And organization was something that Tammany Hall had in spades. And with Aaron Burr at the helm, it seemed like Tammany Hall was going to be an unstoppable force in politics until the incident. In the next episode of the series, we're going to see Tammany Hall take on its opponents with deadly force, literally. We're also going to see how a split inside the organization caused political problems not just for the organization, but for the entire political system in New York. And when times get tough for Tammany, Tammany gets tougher. And even though they may have been down and out at one time, their revival is very short. Here on Geeked on History, we talk about a variety of topics. Topics that I have interest in, that I think that you'll share with me through the enthusiasm that I have for the topics. If you'd like to hear more on topics ranging from early American politics to World War I to World War II even and beyond, please feel free to go to the website at geekedonhistory.com. You'll find a lot of content there, including supplemental blog posts to some of the recordings that we've done. And you'll also find a donate button for both Bitcoin and PayPal if you feel so interested. If you'd like to get in touch with me, please feel free to do that as well. You can contact me at nick@geekedonhistory.com. Or if you're so inclined, please feel free to go to iTunes and look us up. You can find us by searching Geeked on History. And take a quick second and rate and review. Once again, I'm Nick, and as usual, stay geeky.